Does the red suit only make an appearance in closeout games? Worked against the Leafs. It worked against the Jets. Does Bergevin only wear the red suit in closeout games? Is it like Tiger on a Sunday?
Did he wear it for three straight versus Toronto?
This is what I can't remember. No, I don't think so. I think he only wore it in this game seven, if I'm not
mistaken. Chance for them to win.
Yes, yeah, so is it a closeout game for the Habs? That's the only time he wears it? Is he Tiger on a Sunday? Hey, I can close this sucker out. Or does he switch things up a little bit here? You know how superstitious people are.
I'm not a big superstitious person, but if it's working for him, like, why not keep it going? Because what's the harm in wearing it again in only a playoff clinching series moment? Again, you do whatever you can do, I guess, to get a little bit of a heads up, leg up, puck up, whatever you want to call it, on the other team. So it'll be interesting. I'm very much looking forward to seeing this series, Scott. I know we're going to get into it a little bit more about Montreal Canadiens, but like the narrative has always been like, okay, the North was a weaker division. Just was. So like how good is Montreal? They were obviously the fourth seed in the North Division. So that means they're obviously like they're plus 1100 right now, the highest odds to win the Stanley Cup. I did find those odds, not necessarily the series. And I just curious to see, was it that bad? Can they match up against Vegas? Is Vegas and Tampa and the Islanders just heads and tails above what the Habs could do? It'd be nice to see someone just play a different opponent at this point.
It'll be great, and it'll feel a lot different. And as we talked about earlier in the program, to me, though Tampa and the Islanders didn't play this year, it feels very familiar because of what you talked about meeting last year in the conference final, meeting this time again in the Final Four. Not so much for Montreal and Vegas. Where are you on Montreal? And I don't just mean you, Karen. I mean our listening audience as well. And I'll get your answer in just a second. 960, 960, 650, 650. We tweeted this out half an hour ago. Maybe 20 minutes. Montreal will win this series against the Vegas Golden Knights, show well in this series against the Vegas Golden Knights, which implies they ultimately lose it but put up a good fight, or get rolled in this series against the Vegas Golden Knights. And I'm interested to know where our listening audience is a week later, a week that has seen the Montreal Canadiens, as of last Monday, sweep the Jets aside, and then the Vegas Golden Knights come back from two games down to beat the Colorado Avalanche. So there are a couple of things that can affect your opinion. One is the play of the Montreal Canadiens, and the other is the play of the Vegas Golden Knights and how you feel about the strength of that division, and partially what you just talked about, that the narrative for a lot of people, I'm not on the side of this, but a lot of people, the North Division was terrible. It was terrible. It's not a good division. No good teams. None whatsoever. Maybe Toronto, but even they weren't that good. We found out they can't play playoff hockey. I am not on the side of Vegas is going to roll the Montreal Canadiens.
I'm not either. And when you first put this poll out, Scott, it's now got about 400 votes. And early on, at about 100 votes in, it was get rolled was winning by about 47%. And now it's switched. It's show well is a 43%. Get rolled, 36%. And win this series versus Vegas is at 20%. I'm not of the mind of they'll win this series. I do think that their luck, it's not luck that just got them there. They're a very good hockey team. I understand that. But I do think the firepower of the Vegas Golden Knights will just be too much in terms of winning seven games this series. Vegas has won a seven-gamer already, so has Montreal. Vegas played against a very good Colorado team. The only thing I will wonder, and maybe it'll come down to what we see in game one, is will there be an emotional letdown of beating Colorado, a team that you competed and just barely lost the President's Trophy too. A team that was everyone going in was saying that they are the Stanley Cup favorites. I wonder if there is a bit of a letdown in terms of that early on. But again, I just think Vegas is just going to be too good in terms of the caliber of the four lines that they put up there against Montreal.
Doesn't look like Jeff Petrie's going to play tonight. Not sure that influences your decision for the series. He's practicing with that modified glove. I just can't see them getting rolled, not with that goaltender, not with the identity they've created for themselves. They play hard, and maybe it's not as entertaining as a team like Colorado. That doesn't mean they can't win. And that big bruising defense, it will fight back. It really will. Montreal, it's forward group. It's an interesting one. Like, this is the type of series that Josh Anderson is supposed to be built for, and can he lean on Vegas the way Vegas tends to lean on its opponents? He's not the only one up there, but that's a guy they brought in for this express purpose. It's part of the reason they tried to add size in the offseason, Karen.
Yeah, lean on them, Because when that line gets out there, Scott, they do like to throw their body around. They like to forecheck. But I think you need to see a little bit more production from them as well. Like, leaning on in terms of a forechecking being efficient and getting pucks in the back of the net. I agree with you on that. The skill of Nick Suzuki and Cole Caulfield and their line with Toffoli, like, can that break through the big Vegas lines that they have as well? Like, it's just, I just look at Vegas and I just think of each line that they can roll out. And it just, I know Montreal is a good hockey team. I know they shocked a couple of different teams in terms of getting where they are. I think it's a wash in net. I think I would take either one, coin flip. It doesn't really matter to me. But I just think that the depth of the four lines is a bit more talented when it comes to Vegas.
Get those texts in, 650, 650, 960, 960. We can see them coming in. We'll get to them in just a second. We will bring in the judge on this program, Jamie Dodd, producing it once again today. Jamie, you've seen the options on the question we just put out there. How do you view Montreal? Do you view Montreal as, I'm sorry, it's been a good story, you're going to get rolled, show well, or do you actually see the Habs finding a way into the Stanley Cup final?
I think I would vote, I would try to create a fourth option, like between get rolled and show well. I mean, I could easily see them losing in five games, but the games are pretty close and competitive. You know, I'm not expecting to go out there and lose by three or four goals every night, but I do feel like Vegas is deservedly a heavy, heavy, heavy favorite. The reason I would just hesitate to choose get rolled is because, and we've talked about this a lot since we knew this matchup was in the cards, but just the idea that Montreal's defense is well built to do the thing that Vegas has struggled with, or to force Vegas to struggle with, which is that sometimes they have problems getting to the really dangerous areas of the ice. So because of that, you know, I think it could be competitive, but still a relatively short series, if that makes sense.
And I think, too, the recipe is pretty simple for Montreal. It's, you look at what Dallas did last year in the bubble. Keep the high danger chances down, keep a shell around Carey Price, and keep the shots from the outside. For Vegas, it's the same as what Minnesota tried to do in that first round series. Again, keep them to the outside. Colorado, obviously a different style, but I think if Montreal can limit and, you know, not make Carey Price have to make those grade A chances, that's where you do get the, okay, here's your recipe for how you can possibly beat this Vegas team.
Good text coming in right now, Karen. This one from Rager. I think the Habs can pull off the upset, says Rager. Vegas gets into their own heads when they can't beat a goalie who's playing well, and we see Carey Price be that elite goalie he is. The days of Demko's past can come back to haunt them.
Yeah.
I do think there's something to that. I really do. This is a team that has shown itself to be frustrated in the past when it gets a lot of shot volume, but can't quite finish. And this is one of the things about Vegas. Man, they fly up and down the ice, and we talk about the talent on the wings and the blue line and Marc-Andre Fleury and all of that. They have not, over the last couple of seasons, been an elite finishing team. Their shooting percentage is relatively low to their high-danger creation chances. And sometimes that's the other thing that falls into flux as well, that they get a lot of shots, and it looks really nice in the traditional metrics, but where are the shots coming from? Is that the game plan Montreal employs? There's another text coming in, and it's a good point that Paul in South Surrey makes. I believe coaching will decide the series between Vegas and Montreal. I would suggest that Paul is leaning toward the Vegas Golden Knights because Dominique Ducharme is relatively new. I'll put this question out there, though, for the listening audience and you as well. Is Dom Ducharme not getting enough credit for this? We were pretty critical of his tactics or lack thereof early in his coaching decisions and his lineup decisions. He's guided a team in his first two playoff appearances through first two rounds, and he's found a way to get the job done. Should he be getting a little more credit for the success in Montreal?
Well, what was the issue with Montreal, say, post-COVID? It was health, one thing, with some of their players, and trying to find consistency with some lines. And now he's been able to find the consistency. He's got his four lines that he doesn't really deviate from. There's not really, you know, in the blender if things are going right. Like, this is the lines that he likes to roll out. And I think, I was reading a story in The Athletic, I can't remember who wrote it, I can't give credit to them, I apologize for that, but saying that he sat down with each one of these lines and explained to them, this is the identity I want you to have. And if you play with this identity, it's not the same for every line, but if you can play within your strengths and how we want you to play, you'll be successful. I think what you saw in terms of finding chemistry is what happened in that Toronto series. I think you saw it equate into Winnipeg. Yes, okay, they got a little help with Winnipeg's best player being suspended for the rest of that series, but I do think you're starting to see just, they're settling down, and I think Dom Ducharme is settling down behind the bench as well.
Confidence has a lot to do with it as well. And when you believe and you've won seven straight games, and you haven't trailed in any of those seven straight games as well, that goes a long way. Alex the Habs Lover sends this in. When will we stop underestimating Montreal? When it comes down to stats, these divisions never played against each other. It doesn't matter anymore. I think there's something to that as well. I am a believer that if you get to a certain point, you can win. Like, if you get to a certain point of the tournament, I'm sorry. I don't care what happened 2 months ago. I don't care how highly regarded you were coming in. You get to the final, you can, like, Montreal can win the Stanley Cup. They're not the favorite to, and they're going to be an underdog against anybody they play in the conference final. Happens to be Vegas. Anybody coming out of that other series, Montreal will be the underdog again. You get this far, Karen, I'm sorry. You can win this whole thing.
Absolutely. I mean, they've got the one key player that they need that can possibly do that for them as well. And that is Carey Price. And I said it after they won the Toronto series. I am not going to ever bet against Carey Price. Yeah, I said show well in the series because I'm not willing to bet. Like, I didn't say they would win the series versus Vegas. But if you can ride a hot goaltender and he can be Carey Price that he's been in this playoffs, calm, confident, you know, not letting in, you know, a bad goal here or there, but that's about it. I do think that they have that one player that can change the series, or at least they can ride him to the Stanley Cup final. I don't know where you are, so sorry if you said it already, but I think you're probably show well as well in terms of, like, would you go as far as say win the series, or are you going to be more of a show well? Because that's where I'm at.
Show well to me is the obvious answer. Why not? Why not win this series? So put me on record and been proven wrong many times before, and I know it might be the fool's errand at this point. Yeah, put me on record as Montreal finds a way through this. Yeah, I'll say that. I'll say Carey Price makes
Clip
it to
it,
his
Greg.
First Stanley
Clip
Cup
it.
Final. That's fine. I have no problem being wrong on this one. It's just a feeling about this team right now. I do think, Jamie, come into this conversation as well. I think Montreal, to Dave Randor's point, is going to get a lift from that crowd tonight. I really do. I think this group has been overlooked. It's been a group that's been shuttered in Canada for most of the season. I think that crowd actually helps Montreal tonight, don't you?
Yeah, it's an interesting element, and I could see an argument for going either way, right, for the almost a distraction for Montreal, right, because they haven't been in that environment, but I agree that there's a good chance it gives them a huge jolt of adrenaline and a huge lift, right, finally getting to be back in front of a packed house that's noisy like that. I mean, you always think, of course, of, you know, having an incredibly loud barn as an advantage for the home team, but I see the argument very much here that in this case, it could be an advantage for Montreal, actually.
The only thing I would think that maybe could be pose a difficulty is the fact that Montreal has been able to communicate very well on the ice for the last, since they were in the bubble until now, just because they haven't had the crowd noise. So is there some sort of, you see more mistakes happening just because it's a little bit louder in there? They can't make the clear communication that they were. Again, I think energy level will probably overwrite that, but I do think if you see a couple mistakes early on, that's probably to do with the crowd noise and just they can't find the right communication that they had all season long.
There's going to be some focus on Montreal's younger players as well. Hey, haven't been this far. Bigger environment, bigger stage. Look at this. Cole Caulfield strikes me as a guy in particular that was made for the spotlight. Gets better the brighter and hotter that spotlight gets. Doesn't he come across to you that same way?
I mean, Hobie Baker winner, playing in Wisconsin. J.J. Watt, big fan of him. And I just, I do too, though. Like, I think, you know, he has a bit of aura about him that when the stage gets higher, he likes that. I mean, we saw how he scored his first two NHL goals, game-winning goals, overtime goals. We saw the play to Nick Suzuki in game 6, I believe, to beat Toronto. Like, it just seems like when the stakes get higher, his game, nothing. So let's put it this way. No stage is too big for him.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. The officials will have a lot to do with the outcome as well. That's Gary in Maple Ridge. Yeah, that's very true. Traditionally, we see the penalties go away a little bit. Is that good news for Montreal in this series? Maybe. I'm not sure. You can make the argument either way as to how this series is going to be officiated. Generally, if you're going to put the whistles away, that helps the team that is less highly regarded, the team that maybe doesn't have the same amount of skill up and down its lineup, if that's how you view the Habs versus the Vegas Golden Knights.
I do think, though, Montreal's got a 90% penalty kill so far in the playoffs. I guess it helps when Toronto couldn't find the back of the net at all. But I think it might be okay. But this one comes in, unsigned text. Well, I think Montreal is going to get jacked up from Vegas's crowd. But my question is, will Vegas know what to do in Montreal with no crowd, or will they be able to play through the silence that Montreal has been so good in? And you and I have pondered this before on the show, because is there a bit of an advantage to the lack of crowd for Montreal, knowing how to jack themselves up, get up for a game, get that intensity level when things aren't going well, when you don't have the crowd to feed off of? Sorry, that came in from Carter from Nanaimo. But yeah, I wonder if there is a little bit of a lull from Vegas when they do go back to Montreal. 2,500 fans is not 1,800. 5,000 fans is not 1,800. 5,000 might be able to make a bit of a noise, but it's not the same.
What does that number look like by Friday?
I think you'll see more. I don't know if it'll be fully double, because that seems like quite a bit, and they'd have to open a lot of the Bell Center for that. Just increase a lot more capacity, not just the fans, but people working the building. So I could probably see them maybe going 1,000 more, 3,500, something like that.
How much does vaccination play into it? I'm not sure. We'll find out. Keep those texts coming in, 960, 960, or 650, 650. I did see, and I haven't heard Ramdi Ambrosi's comments. If you're just joining us, Canadian Football League, they are going to proceed this year. Season's going to start on August 5th. I know one of the questions that was asked and answered by the commissioner of the CFL about whether you needed to be vaccinated to be in attendance, he said that's going to be decided on a provincial level. That won't be decided by the CFL. It's not going to be a league-wide policy about how you get in. They will look for direction from health officials. That's the right answer here, by the way.
How do they do it in, like, did they do it in the States with, like, MSG, and I guess they do it with the Islanders? Like, do you get a, you and I are not fully vaccinated yet. I do know my mother-in-law is, but I don't know if she has a passport or a card that you have to show. Like, I wonder how they police that.
When I got vaccinated with my first shot, they gave me a card.
I got that too, yeah.
So I would assume that that second line or whatever it is on the card gets filled out. Now I get to carry that around with me. I'll take a photo of it on my phone. Hey, guess what? This is me. Mm-hmm. Here's my health number. I've been doubly vaccinated. I don't know how it's going to go. That's just one of the answers. We'll see if we can get some Ramdi Ambrosi sound for a little bit later on the show. You piqued my interest a little earlier. We didn't touch on it for long, but Novak Djokovic won his 19th Grand Slam over the weekend. He did it in a remarkable fashion. He beat Rafael Nadal in a place where Rafael Nadal does not lose on Friday. Then he comes back from 0-2 down in the final against Tsitsipas. Yes. Well, I've gone through a few different iterations of his name. I was trying to emulate what they were saying on the broadcast as best I could yesterday. But he comes back in the third set. Man, that was the turning point. He's down 40-15. He breaks. Yeah. And then after that, things started to roll. It's his 19th victory. He doesn't have as many as Federer. He doesn't have as many as Nadal. But he might have a better case for being the greatest tennis player of all time already. You are an RFED fan. You are a big Roger fan. I think a lot of our listening audience is. Why would you say Roger's the greatest, Rafa's the greatest, or Novak's the greatest?
So Rafa will always be the greatest on clay. And I know he's won Wimbledon. I know he's won the U.S. Open. He's won he's got all four as well. But Rafa will always be the king of clay. Roger will probably always, in my mind, be the king of grass. Like, what he did at Wimbledon in terms of his dominance there, unbeatable for a while. But I do think when it comes to Novak Djokovic, when this is all said and done, he's going to have the Grand Slam title, because this is how I see it. His age is not an issue with him right now. Roger Federer is he's 39, turning 40 in August. You saw the injuries pile up already. He had two surgeries on his knee. He looked good at the French Open, but you could tell there was some hesitancy there. And the reason he pulled out is because he does want to make a long run at Wimbledon. Rafa, I could see maybe winning one more major, but I don't see Roger winning another one. I don't think he can win five set matches, seven matches in a couple of weeks to win another title in the Grand Slam. Novak Djokovic is healthy. He's younger. The incredible ability for him to play on any surface gives him a chance to win any tournament that he plays. So I do think that just in the end, it'll be Novak Djokovic above the three greats.
Text comes in. Joker has been number one for the longest already. Go. Yeah, he's held the world number one ranking for more weeks than anyone else has done that. We can decide what that means, what it doesn't. Here might be the stat that turns it. He has a winning record against both of those other two guys.
Mm-hmm.
He's gotten the better of them. Now, Nadal has a better Grand Slam head-to-head versus Djokovic than overall. I believe Nadal is 10-7 against the Joker in Grand Slam events. That got a little closer, obviously, with what happened on Friday. The other is this. He's now completed the Grand Slam twice. Mm-hmm. The full Grand Slam twice. He's the only one of the three to have done that. Roger Federer only has the one French Open title. Djokovic has done both twice, for what that matters. It's a really good argument that we have here, because yeah. they're so closely ranked. And what makes it more compelling is you don't have this Tom Brady volume compared to any of the other quarterbacks. You're like, well, look, I still might take Joe Montana in a one-game winner take all over Tom Brady, but the volume of his work is so overwhelming, you can't really argue against it anymore.
No, because the volume of work for Djokovic is right there. He's got 19, and he's beaten Rafa on clay. He's beaten Roger on grass. Like, he's beaten both of those guys on surfaces where they are considered the best of what they did or what they do. I see the style that he plays. And Scott, I watched it with Tsitsipas, and Tsitsipas is going to win majors. I think he's going to win multiple majors. He's a really good tennis player. He's only 22 years old, first Grand Slam final. Oh, by the way, his also grandmother died 5 minutes prior to him taking to the court yesterday. I can only imagine the heavy heart that he was playing with. But for these young guys, I just don't see them. They're the ones that are going to push Novak Djokovic, the younger guys, and I don't see them mentally right now being able to go, okay, I can beat Novak Djokovic. Roger Federer had that. Rafa had it on clay. It was the once you're playing them in a Grand Slam final, that's great. But guess what? You have to get over the mental aspect of you trying to beat Roger Federer at Wimbledon Center Court on a Sunday, you know, like, and I don't see anybody getting over that with Novak Djokovic yet. He's just playing too well.
He is, and yet he's never really been the people's champ. He hasn't.
He tries to be. He wants to endear himself so badly.
At times
he does.
But then he
does something stupid.
This is the thing, and there hasn't been the same widespread respect within even the fraternity of tennis players for him that there has for the other two, and it's what makes the argument that compelling. When you talk about the greatest of all time, how much of it comes down to likability? Is he third in the likability department? When it comes to those three guys, like Nadal yes. has overcome that. Early in his career, there were a lot of people who were down on Nadal. As he's gone on, there are a lot more people on board with him.
Nadal's very... I didn't like him at first only because I was like, oh, he's going to take some Grand Slams away from Roger Federer. Like, and I want to see Fed win them all, right? Like, you think about that marathon match they had at Wimbledon for Nadal to, I believe, win his first Wimbledon and beat Federer there. But I mean, there was early on his career. He's got the showboat and he's got the cutoff sleeves with his arms, the long hair, the capris, the, you know, is he or isn't he question about him in terms of how he got his muscular build on his body. But I think as he got older too, and it does come down to he's able to speak and give his, like, he's able to communicate a lot better now too. And it's very endearing listening to him talk. It's, I don't know, I smile when I hear Rafa talk. He just seems like a really soft-spoken, like, humble guy, surprisingly, for what he is. Novak Djokovic is not humble, and I think that holds it against him. Like, he's the best in the world. He believes he's the best in the world, and he will outwardly tell you that he's the best in the world. I think that has a lot to do with the difference of how you see Rafa and Roger. Because, again, Roger's the same thing. He's so humble.
I smile when I hear our next guest talk about the beautiful game. So I'll be smiling a lot next segment. He is James Sharman from the Footy Prime podcast. He will join us to recap the first weekend in Euro. Two results already in from today. Slovakia, the most recent winner, taking down Poland 2-1. One game on tap. And maybe a little comment on the status of the Canadian men's team as well. James Sharman joins us next on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Two results in the books already today at Euro. We'll talk some soccer here in just a second with our friend James Sharman from the Footy Prime podcast.
So this text came in from Dan when we were talking about Rafa, Roger, and Fed. Rafa, Roger, and Djokovic. And he said, for me about Nadal, it's superstitions before every serving point. It was like Nomar Garcia Parra. And for me, Scott, do you watch him and sometimes go like, I don't know how he remembers all the things that he's superstitious about what he's got to do. Because before he serves, he's got to wipe his eyebrows, put his hair behind. You know, he does the whole picking the pants, the shorts. When he goes to his chair, he's got the water bottles. They have to be in the exact right spot. He's got to put his towel here and this here. It seems exhausting.
And yet calming at the same time. That's a lot of the reason that athletes go through those rituals, whether it's a batter at the plate, and there's been some over the years that Garcia Parra was a good one because the number of times he would adjust the straps and everything on his batting gloves and what he would do with his wristbands and all of that sort of stuff. But whether it's a basketball player for free throws, you see this all the time. This has been a big deal, counting down Giannis and whether he's taken too long. It puts them in their happy place, for lack of a better term. And it's the same with when you're serving or when you're getting ready. And you watched Djokovic yesterday, like the process of I'm going to walk over methodically, use the towel to wipe my face, and then I'm going to return back to the court. And whether it's that or Rafa's, these athletes, I don't even know if it's superstition. It's routine that puts them in a place mentally to perform at their best.
I will do this. Never play the Rafa drinking game in terms of have some drinks every time he does one of those things, because you won't make it out of the first set. And that's happened to me. And let's just say I didn't watch the end of the five setter. However, with Djokovic, it's funny because early on in his career, it used to be the, okay, he would bounce the ball like 12, 14 times if he was nervous. And it was like 5 times if he was on a roll, or it was 7 times if it was, I don't know, second serve versus first serve. Like, he had all these weird quirks as well. I think he's gotten rid of that a bit more as this has gone on. But Rafa is just the epitome of it. And it's just incredible to me. I know you say it's calming, but I just think this is exhausting.
Well, some people, some players have
just to remember
their routines. Some of it comes down to attire as well. Like, how long have we looked at Chapo? Oh, he's going to wear the backwards hat. And then a tournament last month, all of a sudden he's wearing the headband and he's not wearing the, oh, what's going on there? Why is he not wearing the backwards hat? Even Djokovic yesterday, he's wearing the cap. And then right before the final game, he takes the hat off. And I found myself thinking about, I wonder why he took the hat off. Is it sun related? Does he want to win this without the cap on his head? And that's what he wants the picture to look like. is the cap too sweaty? I have no idea. How much of it is functional? How much of it is superstitious, routine based? I don't know.
It's just funny to watch. And Rafa's just, he's the far end of what you want, like what all these players do. But text caught my attention because of the fact that, yes, I had definitely done the Rafa drinking game. It doesn't end up very well if you're going to do it, that's for sure.
I suppose it depends what you consider ending well, because it sounds like it's over early. It's Scott Rintoul. It's Karen Sermon. We'll turn our attention to the beautiful game. He's from the Footy Prime podcast, longtime sportscaster in this country talking soccer, and he joins us here, and he will regularly do so throughout Euro. James, thank you very much for doing this. How are you today?
I'm doing great, thanks. Yeah, really enjoying what's been a pretty compelling tournament so far.
It certainly has, and we can get into the results and which teams have looked best, but you and I both know what the biggest story of this weekend was. It was what happened in the Denmark-Finland match. It was Christian Eriksen. It was the decision to resume the match, though they put it in the hands of the players. It's been questioned by many, including many in the Danish Federation. Where are you at on that decision and the process by which it came to be?
Yeah, it's so difficult, isn't it? And you know, more news is appearing now. Originally, UEFA announced publicly on the weekend that the players decided they wanted to play the game. But the truth of the matter is, it appears, is that they were given 3 options. One was to play the game, to resume the game that day, literally 2 hours after, you know, they thought their teammate, their friend was dying, or play it the next day at noon, or forfeit the match. Now, they're 3 pretty tough options. So you understand why the players decided to play the game on Saturday. The coach, Jarmond, he said that, listen, you know, we couldn't bear the thought of going to bed that night, not sleeping, and then getting on the bus the next day and having to play that game. So they thought the best option was to play the game. But let's be honest, Denmark went into it. He admitted his players had just emotionally gone by that point. It was a terrible choice to make. And I think UEFA have a lot to answer for. I don't know what the right solution is. It's not easy. Obviously, it's a tournament. You have to get these games in somewhere, but surely it would be impossible. And to put those players on the spot, you know, within 2 hours of witnessing that, which, I mean, I'm not sure if you guys watched it. It shook me. I'm still shaken by it. I can't imagine being on that field and seeing your teammates. So what a tough position to be in for everyone involved. But if you ever gave them those 3 choices, that seems callous.
I am right there with you. I was watching it live. I was shaken. My wife was shaken. I did not know how to handle myself after. I can't even imagine being a player in that instance. It does speak to the greater lack of confidence in governing bodies in soccer. The only time we've thought positively about UEFA in any recent memory is when the plans for the Super League somehow made UEFA look good. What do we see as the actual guiding compass in this sport right now? Where is our confidence level at when it comes to the game that so many in this on this planet hold dear?
Yeah, it's been low for a long time. Obviously, it kind of all started with FIFA, of course, and the corruption globally of a few years ago, something that we've known had been happening for a long time. And UEFA was very much in the background. But UEFA are out for themselves, out for money, number one. And we understand why that is, but they're also ruthless in the way they want to make money at the expense of the players in most cases. You know, let's be honest, there's too much football each year. These athletes are exhausted. There's more and more serious injuries because they play too many games. That's one issue that UEFA have failed to deal with. There's the issue of racism in the game. We see it year in and year out, and the punishments are pathetic by the governing body. So you add all that in, and then you add them having this weekend, and as per usual, UEFA comes off looking really bad. I don't know what the solution is, but the players, the clubs, and the agents don't like UEFA. They think they could run the game better themselves. I don't know about that, because they're just as greedy, let's be honest. I don't know what the solution is, guys. I don't, but UEFA have had reforms in recent years. Let's hope they're getting better, but still, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And in any multi-billion dollar industry, there's going to be a lot of, as mentioned the word before, but callousness. And, you know, all about them and not about the greater good of the game, unfortunately.
James, let's talk about what was happening on the pitch. I want to go back to Friday. It seems like such a long time ago now. And it was that initial opening match between Italy and Turkey, 3-0 for the Italians. What did you see from the Azzurri in that one that you liked?
I saw plenty. They were fantastic. And, you know, entering this tournament, I've been looking forward to seeing Italy play for some time. They're not the old Italy who were cemented in defense first, the old Catenaccio style. This is a team with a nice blend of talent, old and new. At the back, they're still quite old, real veterans, and Bonucci and Chiellini and company. But moving forward, they're a bunch of young, dynamic players, really making names for themselves. No superstars just yet, but an excellent team and a team that plays football the right way under Roberto Mancini. And we saw that against Turkey. They went at Turkey. Now, Turkey were disappointing, to say the very least. They were a team that many had as a dark horse, and I'm sure they'll get better, but they were poor. But that was mainly because Italy made them look poor. They were great to watch, and it's so refreshing. You know, I think we all missed Italy at the World Cup in 2018. That was a nightmare scenario for all Italian football fans. They couldn't even comprehend the thought of their team not being there, but they bounced back. And this is a new generation on the cusp of it anyway. And I think this team could be, you can't call Italy a dark horse. I think that's a bit unfair on Italy because they're still the Azzurri. But they're a team, perhaps a less fancied team, that could go a very long way in this tournament.
England winning its first match at a Euro for the first time. That's a crazy stat. That's incredible to me that that's a stat that's out there. Anyways, but they win 1-0. Raheem Sterling gets the goal for the English. When they're playing their best, though, it's like high tempo, high pressing game. Did you see some good signs of that going forward for the English?
I do, and you're putting me on the spot with England. You know, I've been down this road before with this team so many times. And, they look good. This could be the year, but this time around, there's something different about this side in that they're very likable, they're very young, and their best players are very much attacking players who go at teams and don't seem to be fazed by, you know, parts of the game where teams in the past may have crumbled. So that bodes really well. Obviously, they made the semifinals of the World Cup, albeit a pretty easy path back in 2018, but I like this team a lot. Now, the issue with this team and the path this year is it's much harder. They'll be playing one of France or Portugal, likely, or even Germany, maybe, in the round of 16. And in those games, I would not favor England just yet. Maybe in next year's World Cup, a year from now, when they've matured a bit more, I would favor them more. But it's a very difficult path. But this England team, yeah, under Gareth Southgate, they seem to have themselves together. And they play a nice brand of football, albeit slightly pragmatic for some, because a lot of that attacking talent is left on the bench. But still, they're a fun team to watch. And England, I won't say England's back because, hey, listen, the 60s was a long time ago, right? When they last won any kind of major silverware. But yeah, the future looks very, very good, and maybe the present as well.
So a lot of people were having a laugh at the post-match interview with Raheem Sterling and the question, have you justified your selection? James Sharman joining us here, talking Euro and all things about the beautiful game. And it was kind of an out-of-left-field question, but it also spoke to me about the fact that England, because it has the possibility of playing all of its matches at home for this entire tournament, maybe there's even more pressure than would have been possible had this been at a different country in Europe, a centralized location. Do you buy that?
Yeah, listen, home field advantage, it's not just, you know, something we talk about. It's a real thing. Definitely, you know, it's an advantage for England, who potentially could get to the final playing just one game away from home. That's amazing. That really helps, especially with the fans coming back slowly but surely. Now, as I mentioned before, previous England teams have crumbled under that pressure, but they're still, generally speaking, a very good home team. And I don't think this team will crumble. But yeah, I think it's a huge advantage. And you mentioned Raheem Sterling in the interview. It was quite amusing, actually. I think it was Kelly Cates was the interviewer, and she's excellent at her job, actually. And she asked a good question, you know, were you justified in your selection? And quite frankly, Raheem Sterling has been a shadow of his former self in the last few months at Man City. He hasn't played well. He's been dropped by his manager, Pep Guardiola. And it was a bit controversial for him to get his spot back on the team, starting this one, given how well some other players are playing. But he rewarded that faith with a goal and a great performance, and he'll definitely start the next match. So it was a good question, but you know, Raheem Sterling's a great guy. I think he's done a lot for a lot of programs in England. He got an MBE on the weekend as well, actually, for his work against racism in social media. So, it was a funny moment, a good moment, but I thought he handled it very well.
I thought so as well. I understand why he took pause and asked the question back, though, because there's one goal scored in the match. He's the guy who scored it. I'm not sure how else you would justify your selection than being the only guy who scored in a match and provided the difference in the margin of victory.
Yeah, but I guess it's just a controversy, you know, entering the match. I think the question was, you know, said in such a way that clearly you did justify it. Please explain to us your thoughts about perhaps the news and the narrative surrounding your selection. So maybe that's what it was. But you listen to these English players being interviewed, and they've been trained very well. They're not giving much away. They're not very outspoken. And I think that's all part of Gareth Southgate's goal. Let's keep controversy out of this camp, because, listen, let's be honest, in recent and distant memories with this England team, there's always controversy, right, surrounding them. Let's try and keep it out this time around.
Speaking of goals, did we see the goal of the tournament to this point this morning? Czech Republic, Patrick Schick, the goal from just over the midway line. Is that the best goal we've seen so far in this tournament?
Oh, I think it has to be. Yeah, there's been some good ones. There's a good one, actually, for Slovakia just now as well. A very good goal. But that was incredible. It was a bad giveaway by Scotland in the midfield. But the way he bent that ball, 51 yards it carried, 51 yards, and it took 3 seconds. So it took a while. And it bent in over poor old David Marshall, who could be criticized, maybe, for being off his line. I'll talk to our good friend Craig Forrest about that later today. But, I mean, my word, it was superb. That might stay as the goal of the tournament, because I don't care where the goalkeeper was. To hit the target with the ball at that pace, bending like it did, was just brilliant. And I think so far, we've seen some really great goals in this tournament, and we've seen some really good games so far. So it started off well, not quite as defensive as some people may have thought.
It's one thing to be caught maybe a little out of position and concede a great goal. It's another to crash into the net with the force he did and instantly become a meme.
Yeah, exactly, right? I know we'll be seeing that for years. And poor old Scotland, right? Their first tournament since 1998. High hopes, and this was really a must-win game in that group, because Croatia and England, you know, you would think would take care of Scotland. So I felt bad for them, but I give the Czechs a lot of credit. No one's talking about the Czech Republic at all. No one. And they probably quite like that, because they got some good skilled players, and Schick being a prime example of what they can do, because not many guys could do that from that position. And, it's, you know, we do see sometimes balls looping over a goalkeeper, his obvious line, but when you see it hit the ball with that kind of velocity, it's a thing of beauty, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. It reminded me a little bit of that Carly Lloyd goal, remember, from the 2015 World Cup. Not quite as incredible, but still from half against Japan. And, of course, the U.S. going on to win gold there. I want to talk about Robert Lewandowski. Of course, playing for Poland. He's one of the most prolific goal scorers in the world. He plays with incredible talent at Bayern Munich, but the talent just isn't there on his Polish squad. How tough is it? I don't say how tough is it for him because he's going to play for a country, but disappointing to see his prime years, and it just doesn't look like it's going to be there for Poland.
Yeah, you know, it happens, right? We see some of these great players who just don't have that impact internationally that other players do. And listen, he's a proud Polishman. But, you know, he hasn't got the supporting cast. He's had good teams around him in the past. And listen, Poland's not a bad team by any stretch. But you look at what he does at Bayern Munich, and he has so many great players around him. Thomas Müller is like his foil. You got, you know, Alfonso Davies and, you know, Kamal Musiala bursting up the wings either side to supply great balls to him. And listen, he's had a great career. He's one of the great players we've ever seen in that position. And he probably is the best number nine in the world at the moment. But, you know, internationally, it doesn't always happen. Remember George Best, you know, who arguably is the best of all time. Never played in the World Cup. Played for Northern Ireland, right? Never had the opportunity. It does happen. But I haven't got too much sympathy for these guys because, hey, listen, he's had a pretty good career. And most years, you know, I'm very, very envious of him because, listen, playing for Bayern Munich week in and week out is a pretty special experience for him. But it is what it is, you know. At this current era generation of Polish football, the stars aren't quite coming like perhaps they should be. But, hey, he's still revered there, and he's still their best player of all time.
Spain, Sweden coming up here right away. What should we be looking for in this match, James?
Yeah, well, he won't be looking for Sergio Busquets, the captain of Spain, of course, and the legend of Barcelona. He has COVID. He's in quarantine right now. He'll be out for a while. Spain is a team a bit like Germany, actually, in this year's tournament. That they're, again, a team in transition, but they are still Spain. They've got some wonderful, wonderful talent. They could go a long way in this tournament against Sweden team. Sweden's good. You know, people are discounting Sweden right now because Ibrahimovic pulled out injured late in the qualifying campaign and just before the Euros began. But, you know, he was never meant to be there to start with. He invited himself back into the squad and then he got hurt. So this is a team that was moving forward without Ibra. I think they're a good young team. I really do. And I think they'll cause Spain some issues today, but I think Spain will take it, even though it's not the Spain of 2008, 10, and 12, where they were unbeatable, essentially, just an incredible team.
Our Swedish listeners will be dismayed by that prediction. While we're on the subject of prediction, and I don't want to completely go over the match that still remains today, but Group F goes tomorrow. It's Hungary, Portugal, it's France, Germany. This is the group of death in this tournament. How primed are you for what we're about to see tomorrow?
Yeah, this is the day, right, we've been looking forward to. And that group is just ridiculous. Obviously, Hungary are the whipping boys, so to speak. But they're a good young team, Hungary. You know, they won't make it easy for any of their opponents. And they, you never know, they could take a point. Although I think Portugal, for me, are the second favourites in this tournament. I like Portugal a lot. They're going to be a very, very tough, tough beast to slay. But, of course, the big one being France, Germany. Tomorrow, France are, for me, the big favourites in this year's tournament. And they're a tournament team. So they build momentum, which means they may not be at their best tomorrow. So I can see a draw happening tomorrow between Germany and France. Because Germany, you can't write off just yet. There's no way, even though they're not what they once were. You can't write them off. So perhaps a draw in that one and a Portugal win against Hungary, giving Portugal the edge entering that huge one, France-Portugal, which might be, you know, who knows, the match of the tournament.
It might be. Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. Now, you're not talking to a couple of geography majors, but we know enough to know that Canada does not participate in Euro because of geography. Have been participating in World Cup qualifying, however. In your mind, and I know the job isn't done yet, how encouraged should Canadian soccer fans be by what they've seen in the last week?
They should be very encouraged. It's been, you know, a great few weeks for Canadian soccer. Now, that said, we have to all be realistic here and realize that the quality of opponents hasn't been there. Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Suriname, and now Haiti. Now, Haiti's a better team, and they caused some issues in a horrible, horrible environment and pitch on the weekend. But Canada have, you know, in attacking sense of the word anyway, the best team maybe we've ever seen. They're excellent, and they should qualify for the Octagon if they can get through Haiti on Tuesday, which I think they'll do. And then, you know, who knows, 3.5 berths for CONCACAF for the World Cup next year. And are they better than three teams there? Well, you know what? I mean, States and Mexico, they're better. Let's be honest here. They're still much better. But Honduras and Panama, Jamaica, listen, these are teams that Canada could potentially upset and beat. So if I'm a Canadian fan right now, and I am, It's been years of heartbreak, years of frustration. So let's jump on this bandwagon. Let's enjoy this right now, because there's some players playing for Canada right now who we have not seen before ever for this team. So enjoy it, support them, and hope for the best, because I'm feeling pretty good about them.
Amen. I just hope we get to see them in matches of that magnitude that matter against the U.S., against Mexico. That's what I want to see. I want to see how this young squad fares against those teams and get that experience built in for hopefully bigger and better things on the international stage. James, excellent stuff. Looking forward to doing this with you throughout the course of Euro. Have a great podcast later on today, and we will talk later this week.
Thanks, guys. Enjoyed that. Chat soon.
Thanks,
James. Absolutely. That is James Sharman of the Footy Prime podcast. He does that with Craig Forrest, who will be our other regular every second day. We will talk soccer, and it'll be really nice to talk to Craig on Wednesday as well. We talked to him last week before Canada-Haiti leg one. Now we'll get to talk to him on the flip side of it, and hopefully the business is done by Wednesday.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it will be. They could have won that game 4-0 from everything that I saw in the highlights and read. I did see Scott, like, Haiti did a really good job of trying to keep Alphonso Davies out of, like, they heavily put the field, shifted it towards the left side of Alphonso Davies. He tried to go to the right a little bit, but yeah, it's like they know where Canada's getting its offensive push from, and they did everything they could. Give him a better pitch, give him a couple of days for the tactics to change. If they do, I think we'll see Canada a very positive outcome Tuesday night, 6 o'clock Pacific time, I believe.
And here's the other part of that, Karen, is that for years in this country, we've counted on one player on the roster. Well, hopefully this player scores, because if this player doesn't score, I have no idea where the offense is going to come from. And it's not as though Canada has more attacking options than some of the big countries in CONCACAF. But the fact that if you bottle up Alphonso Davies and you commit extra resources to him, oh yeah, I forgot about Kyle Larin. He can actually score, and it's not just Davies. It's not just Jonathan David. Oh, yeah, they got a guy like Kyle Larin. They have other attacking options. There are multiple weapons on this team, and it's something we just have not been used to for the Canadian contingent over the years.
Talk about multiple weapons. I don't know anything about the Spain team. Like, is Iniesta still there? I don't think he is anymore. I think is Shakira's husband still playing for them, Scott, in the back? I have no idea. Like, I'm very curious to watch this team, because we grew so accustomed to the old guard and the tiki-taka, how they used to play soccer, and just how dominant force that they were. So I know we've got another hour of this show, but I'll be very tuned into the second half of this game just to see what Spain is going to put out there.
I've got it on my screen as well, so we'll update you as to any news that happens. If there are some goals scored in this match, we'll let you know as it gets going. Final match of the day over at Euro. Breaking news earlier today, the CFL is a go for 2021. They'll get going in early August. There are schedules to come out. It's going to happen tomorrow. And they poured a little water on something I hoped was going to happen for one reason. I'll tell you what that is next on Rintoul and Sermon.
You're listening to Rintoul and Sermon.
They were going to get ripped for it by some people, Karen, if they did it. And that's fine. That's fine. If people are talking about the CFL, that's probably a good thing. And there's some people talking about the CFL today, because there's good news for the Canadian Football League today, Karen.
There is. They have, the Board of Governors have ratified the season. August 5th, Scott, mark your calendars. Schedule is going to be coming out tomorrow. We'll see kind of how the schedule is impacted by what's going on in certain states right now, certain provinces right now, and how health authorities within each of those provinces. But the good news is the Board of Governors unanimously 14-0 in favor of having the CFL season start on August 5th.
I haven't asked you about this, but last year at this time, I didn't feel the CFL had to play to survive. In fact, I thought quite the opposite. I thought, look, don't throw something together ham-handed. Use this time to figure out a better model business-wise for your game. Try to figure out some of the issues you've had for years as a league. Use it wisely. Sure, I would have liked to have seen CFL last year, but I didn't feel the same desperation for the league that I felt this year. Like, if you don't play this year, we got really big problems, so I'm really happy that the Canadian Football League is going to give it a go this year.
I mean, there's the way of looking at it, Scott, out of sight, out of mind, right? There's that aspect. So if you're not playing for 2 years, how do you get back to it? You've got players that are under contract that may decide not to come back, depending on what happens, if, say, they didn't play this season. You've got just the financial aspect of how much money could just be lost by these teams not getting the revenue coming in from gates and merchandise and whatever the case may be, but still having to pay employees. We did see a lot of, you know, CFL teams have to decrease their staff during this, as we saw with many across many sporting leagues around the world, because of the fact there wasn't the revenue coming in. So I was of the mind, yes, they could survive last year, but I was more of the, they need eyes on the product this year, and they need fans in the stands, and we don't know what that's going to look like just yet. The expectation is, I know Jason Kenney has come out in Alberta, and he seems to think by August, like, they can have pretty full stadiums. BC, I'm not quite sure what Dr. Bonnie Henry has in mind at this point. Ontario, they're not quite there yet to saying that now, but hopefully they're trending in the right direction. So I just thought it was imperative for them to get back on the field this year.
You wonder what it'll be like in Winnipeg, defending Grey Cup champs. Easy to forget that they're the defending Grey Cup champs, but we know that things have been very difficult from a COVID perspective in Manitoba right now. They don't have to make any hard and fast decisions. This can be made leading up. We can figure it out as we go. Now, one of the things we wondered is that with a 14-game season, there was speculation that perhaps the CFL would say, we're going to have an 18 playoff this year. And this is the part they would have been ripped on by a lot of people. Hold on a second. You got 9 teams and 8 of them are going to the playoffs. So that would have been part of the conversation. And I admit, from a competitive standpoint, that sounds a little hokey. But I was here for the conversation about, you know what? You've lost a lot of revenue. If this gives you an opportunity to have a couple more games, games with stakes, venues that have people in them, revenue generation for not only the teams but the players as well, I'm here for that conversation. And it also meant that it might come with a single conference. Hey, we're going to just rank the teams, not east and west as it has been tradition. You're just going to get your record and we'll slot the matchups that way. Doesn't sound like they're going to go that way. Sounds like they're going to go more traditional, Karen. East Division, mm-hmm. West Division, probably go with the traditional 16 playoff, top team in each division getting a bye.
Yeah, Randy Ambrosi said they are open to some changes, but did like the fact that they pretty much like the traditional East versus West. It's, you know, it's got its own quirks to it in terms of the crossover. We all know that. And usually the crossover doesn't happen to have a West team or two East teams in the Grey Cup. I just think that they want to keep it probably as traditional as they can. And again, I don't know. I didn't see his press conference. We'll have to see if there's any quotes out there. I don't know if he was asked anything to do with, are there anything going further forward with the XFL? I have no idea on that. I don't think they addressed that at all, but I don't know. They also addressed the fact that maybe, we don't know, but if the provinces decide that you have to be fully vaccinated to get into a stadium, does that increase capacity of what you could have? That's something I guess the provincial health authorities have to figure out. But this is why they had to make this decision now. They had to make it now because the logistics they still have to figure out, right? There's still so many things that we don't know that they've probably been working on behind the scenes, but there still is a lot to health-wise, concern-wise, getting players up here that they had to figure out before that August 5th date.
Grey Cup is in Hamilton this year on December 12th. That's when it is scheduled to be played. Part of me wonders if sticking with the East-West format has something to do with that. Hey, in the past few years, the West has been much stronger. Do we really want to go down the path of giving a better opportunity for there to be an all-West final in an Eastern venue? Maybe it's better for us strategically to help the Eastern teams. And as you pointed out earlier, it's a very fair point. Like, even the most ardent CFL fans, they probably don't know what's on their team's roster right now. They certainly don't know the context. There are going to be players that were last playing in 2019 that have since retired simply because they aged out or they found other work and they made different family decisions. There are going to be a lot of players you've never heard of because we just haven't seen these teams in a while. Yeah, you've got some of the stars still. You mentioned Bo Levi Mitchell. You got Mike Riley. You know Trevor Harris is going to be slinging it. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of changes along the way. I am interested to know, in markets that have struggled for attendance, BC, for example. BC struggled in recent years for attendance. It's not exactly a secret. With no Vancouver Canadiens baseball that we know of coming to Vancouver this summer. And hey, maybe that changes later this summer, but not right now. Vancouver Whitecaps, we don't have any reason right now to think that they're going to be playing at home. Right now, they're based in Utah. So in BC, for example, does the casual sports fan who might not be a CFL fan say, you know what? This is something I can do. And I haven't been able to do anything for a really long time. that's how you might need to market it if you're the BC Lions, for example. If you're the Toronto Argonauts, for example. Look, I know you'd love to go to a Blue Jays game. We'd love to go to Blue Jays games. But we can't do that right now. So why not embrace something we can do? Is there the possibility of getting the casual out simply because of that aspect of this?
You have, there's a commercial that runs on 650 and it talks about getting back on the road again. And it's just like, now's the time to get back on the road again, Scott. And I think that's how it has to be looked at in terms of getting butts in seats. And I think that will be a hot commodity. I think people are going to be starving to see live sports. We've seen what the venues are like in the States. You see full baseball stadiums, you see full hockey arenas. It's just, it's a getting back to a normalcy I keep talking about. And I think the fact that, yes, they can market to that, but I'm really hoping that people are just really excited to get out and go watch live sporting events again. And they are a prime ticket because there's what going to be 5,000, 6,000. That's like, I have no idea what the capacity is going to be at initially to start off. But you know what? I know I want to be one of those people in the stands. I will be a paying person to sit there because I want to go back and see live sports. I want to be in the atmosphere, the competitive atmosphere. You know, it's a nice afternoon, have a couple drinks, have some popcorn, just be with other people cheering for one common goal. I am so looking forward to that. And I hope others are too. And it is something that people want to do.
Yeah, and as restrictions loosen up in Alberta, as they loosen up here in BC, more confirmation that's happening in the next couple of days. Hey, you can go on road trips again. You can gather up to 50 people, and 50 is not enough to have at a Canadian Football League game. But we'll bring Jamie into this conversation as well, producer of the program, co-host at times as well. Jamie, you're not a traditional CFL fan, but you've got a young family. You guys have been cooped up as well over the course of the last year, 15 months. Is this an opportunity that would be more appealing to you than perhaps it would have been in recent years because you haven't had the chance to do something? I'm not sure we have his mic on. We'll see if we can get him on in a second. But we can ask people out there as well. I do agree with you, Karen. I think the thought of being somewhere with other people, especially in a stadium where you're probably socially distanced,
mm-hmm.
and you can sit there in the sun and have a beer and just have a relaxed afternoon in an environment you haven't been in for a long time, I do think it's a little more appealing. We'll see if it's marketed that way. It's Rintoul, it's Sermon, possibly joined by Jamie Dodd when we figure out the technical difficulties as well. You as well, 960, 960, 650, 650. We're not calling it the Western Conference Final, but the other NHL Stanley Cup semifinal goes tonight between Vegas and Montreal. What are you calling it? Are you round three? Are you conference final? Where are you?
I'm going to default to the Western Conference. It's so bad. I've called it the Western Conference Finals so many times just because Vegas is in it. And it's, I don't know. I have no idea why, but it just, to me, in my mind, it's the West and the Islanders and Tampa Bay is the East. And who cares that Montreal's an Eastern team? Doesn't matter. It's the Western Conference Final. I guess I'll try and figure out the semifinals, but maybe I'll have to have like the swear jar if I keep calling it the Western Conference Finals.
Well, I had to contribute like earlier in the program.
You said the Edmonton... wrong
the
team,
old
team earlier this season. The old team.
The Edmonton
hey,
old
that,
team.
That one is going to get me probably multiple times as well. But yeah, you know what? I'm looking forward to seeing this game tonight. Game one, I'm looking forward to seeing two teams that haven't played each other all season. I want to see what Montreal stacks up against. I want to see if they can feed off of the energy in that building. I think there's just so many question marks that we don't know about the series. We talked about the fact we knew a lot about Tampa and the Islanders. They played 1 year ago in the bubble to get to the Stanley Cup final. Teams are basically the same. This is a whole new ball game for Montreal and Vegas.
The curiosity factor is so much higher in this series for all of the reasons you just described. We just threw this out there on Twitter today, and you can vote there. You can hit us up in the inbox as well, 960, 960 or 650, 650. The Montreal Canadiens will either win this series against Vegas, show well in this series against Vegas, or get rolled by Vegas. 45% of you are in the middle on this one. 45% of you think Montreal is going to show well, but 35% that Montreal think Montreal is going to get steamrolled. Count me completely out on that. Habs aren't getting steamrolled. Clip it if you want, Greg. A week from now, maybe I'm going to look like an idiot. I just don't think Montreal is going to roll over in this series. I don't think Vegas is so overwhelmingly better that Montreal isn't going to be able to compete in this series.
Hey, you've said it to me all the time. You aren't surprised by anything anymore. Columbus swept Tampa Bay out of the playoffs 2 years ago. Like, anything could happen. Montreal's playing, they're on a heater right now. One, they haven't trailed in how many weeks now? they have one of the best goaltenders in the league in terms of how he's playing in the playoffs. It could be a wash. I mean, I would put it a wash between him and Marc-Andre Fleury, but I do think that it would be fool's gold, I think it is personally, to count Montreal out.
Yeah, for a lot of different reasons, and not the least of which is Carey Price. Yeah. Seems silly to just completely discount Montreal on that alone, but then let's respect the rest of the roster and let's respect the balance that they've had over the course of these last seven games. Haven't trailed in any of them. We've had some suggestions coming in as to what we should call this, by the way. The best one I've seen so far, Karen, and you can check 650, 650, 960, 960, some of the listener suggestions. Craig, ardent listener to the program, says, call it the Northwest Conference Final. Makes sense.
Well, there you go.
North Division versus West Division Conference Final. You found a way to incorporate all of it, Craig. I like that.
I like that. Maybe we can get sponsored by, I don't know, whatever the divisions were in the regular season. I like that one. It's just, it's a bit of a David versus Goliath, but also just maybe it's not because of just how well Montreal is playing. They seem to have found a groove. And I don't know if Winnipeg is that much worse competition than Vegas. I don't know if Toronto is that much worse competition than Vegas. Did Montreal get a little help in the Winnipeg series? Maybe. Would Mark Scheifele have really made a difference? I mean, we'll never know. Auston Matthews, Mitch Marner couldn't find the back of the net. But is that more on what Montreal did versus how they were playing in their heads? I mean, there's so many questions to know because we just haven't seen it so far.
Last year, conference final, Vegas was there. Vegas was supposed to take care of Dallas. Vegas was supposed to take care of Dallas last year, and this has been a really nice run for the Dallas Stars, but Vegas is the better team. All right, they got all the bugs out of their system. Shouldn't have taken as long as they did against Vancouver, but that's done. They're back out in five games. That was it. Done. Dallas took care of business. I don't know how many similarities we see between last year's Dallas Stars team and this year's Montreal Canadiens team. There's a lot.
Corey Perry.
You know, sure, there's your common link. Dave in Richmond says the Habs have team defense. Offense gets you to the playoffs. Defense wins in the playoffs.
So what Dallas did last year, and doing a little research in terms of how Montreal has a bit of a template on what to do to try and slow down the Golden Knights, and Minnesota did it as well. It's just in the end, they just didn't have enough firepower to go over Vegas. But in the five games they played last year in the bubble, Vegas outshot Dallas 166 to 118. But in terms of what the high danger chances were, and I can't remember who the goaltender was for Dallas back then. Doesn't really matter.
Hudobin.
But that's who it was, right? He was able to see the shots, and Dallas was able to play team defense. Five players always in the view of the camera. Like, it was just, that's what Montreal has to do, and that's basically what they kind of did against Toronto and what they did against Winnipeg to a point. So I think they have the ability to do it with how they play already. It's just a matter of, can they counterattack enough punch to beat Vegas in a seven-game series?
Hudobin was the guy who had the great quote, "We're not going home!" He had that great quote last year as well. After one of those great
games. It seems like a lifetime ago. It just seems like a lifetime ago. I forget what happens back then.
You're right, because so much has happened, and it's been crammed into such a small space as well. I absolutely agree with you on that. 100%. The other thing that we wondered last week, and I haven't had your opinion on this, Karen, as well, is that I wondered how many more people in Canada would, though not inclined to cheer for Montreal, would turn their affinity toward Montreal simply because they don't want to see Vegas have the success. Like, this was a really big thing in the first year, but there are still people that are on that train. I don't hold it against Vegas whatsoever. Not at all. But I do know there are people in this country that are anybody but Vegas fans. You know, John in Vancouver texted in the opposite. He's a Leafs guy, and so he said anybody but Montreal. We had a bunch of people late last week saying, anybody but Vegas. It's not their fault about the rules. I still don't care. I don't want to see a team this young have this kind of success this quickly.
Yeah, there's no pain in terms of what the Vegas Golden Knights have experienced. Maybe it was just that, was it game six against San Jose, game seven against San Jose. That's their one painful experience that they do have in the history, I guess, losing the Stanley Cup final. But here's the thing. How can you hold it against them when the league basically gave them the tools to make this team and they took advantage of it? It's like saying, I don't want Tampa Bay to win because they're $18 million over the cap. But they're not, because there's no cap in the playoffs. So are you going to hold that against them? It just, to me, it's, I see them kind of in the same light. Julian Breezeball, Tampa Bay did everything that they could to work within the rules in the regular season, and now they're exploring the postseason rules. I think Vegas is just a really good hockey team, and they've done everything that they could to work within the confines. And hey, they had their struggles this year. They played 15 players at one point, and it cost them the President's Trophy. Like, it's not like they have had not their struggles in terms of what they put on the ice, but I just think, get over anybody but Vegas. They're a good hockey team. I just want to watch good hockey if my team's not playing.
Yep, I'm right there with you. And it was as much about other general managers failing to do their job properly as it was about Vegas doing its job properly in the expansion draft, everything that followed, and credit for changing their view. Hey, they had the view that most expansion teams have. We want to be competitive, but really this is about 3 to 5 years from now. Nope, we're way better than even we thought we were going to be. They turned their tactics. They started cashing in some chips early, and that's fine. Good for them. Good for Vegas in that regard. Just a note on that Tampa Bay, $18 million over, and I know the quote got a lot of run, even though Dougie Hamilton wasn't criticizing that. Like, he made it very clear that they did everything within the rules. He was using that as a reference to how talented the team was. Why do people, like, as many smart hockey fans as there are in this country, why do people think Tampa Bay invented this? Oh, yeah, the first team ever to go over the cap limit with LTIR. Like, go back to Patrick Kane and the injury at the end of that season with the Chicago Blackhawks. Go further back. Like, the Vancouver Canucks 10 years ago were into LTIR and the way they utilized it at that time. Like, this has been going on for a really long time in the National Hockey League. Tampa didn't just invent this.
It's just so much more out when it's the former Hart Trophy winner. It's Nikita Kucherov. It is, you are literally getting back like 40 goal scorer in your lineup for the Stanley Cup Finals. And but again, it just the way it happened. They still managed to get to the playoffs and be a really good team without him. They just got the luxury of having him back. Speaking of Dougie Hamilton, did you hear the news today, Scott, out of Elliot Friedman had out earlier this morning? He's given permission to possibly do like a sign and trade. I guess the only benefit to doing that, it never happens in hockey. I mean, we've seen it in the NBA. We've seen it. Chris Bosh is one of the more famous ones. He signed Toronto, traded to Miami. But maybe this is one of the situations where it does happen because it's Tom Dundon and they do things different in Carolina. I have no idea. Would he lowball him in terms of that? I don't know. But he has to be, other than maybe Taylor Hall, probably the one of the most sought-after free agents this offseason. Can we agree on that?
I think he's so much more sought after than Taylor Hall. I don't even really think it's close in that regard. I agree with you that he will be at the top of the list. Taylor Hall, I think it is very mixed reviews around the league on Taylor Hall. I get the sense Taylor Hall is going to re-sign in Boston. I think that's what he wants. I think that's probably what they want, and they're probably going to get some type of discount because he likes the environment, and he likes the fit, he likes the organization that he's a part of. That's just my read from here. As far as the Dougie Hamilton thing, I've tried to wrap my head around this a little bit because you're right. Sign a trade never happens. I wonder if this is some kind of tactic on Carolina's part to say, okay, technically you can't talk to teams until that courting period. Okay? But if we give you permission to seek a sign and trade right now, this is a way you can find out what the market looks like for you. And maybe it indicates that what we're going to offer you is a lot closer than you thought. And maybe the market you think exists doesn't exist. Is it a calculated gamble on the part of the Carolina Hurricanes? Less about, hey, we're going to get assets back. Because if Dougie Hamilton hears from another team, unless he's like dead set on getting that eighth year, like that's the only reason a sign and trade makes sense if you're going to free agency anyway. That's the only reason a sign and trade makes sense for the team. Hey, we can get an asset back for something we're going to lose anyway. But from the player's perspective, I can get an eighth year if I do a sign and trade here. I wonder if it's calculated on Carolina's part of, go out there, see what's out there. You might wind up back here because you like the environment. You like somewhat of the anonymity we have relative to some markets around the league, and you just might not get the money you thought you were going to get. I wonder if it's
I think it's fully calculated. I agree with you. I can't poke holes in that because I do think it also getting out there in the world is calculated as well. Oh, Dougie Hamilton's available for maybe we can talk to him. We weren't sure and now we can talk to him and maybe there's more suitors out there and his agents is, I don't know who released the information to Elliot Friedman, but maybe it's the agent, JP Barry, putting it kind of out there into the world. Because if you're Dougie Hamilton, do you really want to leave a really good Carolina team that looks to be primed to be very good for going forward. Again, you don't have your head coach locked up yet, so who knows what the situation is right there.
Bingo, right there, right there. Bingo, 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 bingo. I wonder how many players in that room, not that they're all unrestricted free agents, Karen, but I wonder how many players in that room are saying, if you don't sign this guy, then what? Like, what are you telling us? And this guy doesn't seem to have asks that are astronomical here. But as Kevin Weeks came on this program last week and told us, every day that goes by that he's not signed, you got to wonder. Like, what's going on here? This was supposed to have been done a long time ago. Every day we march a little closer to Rod Brind'Amour, at least hearing from other teams. What does that say about his future? What does it say about the organization? This one comes in from Bob in Nanaimo. Please, not another week of you guys misrepresenting the anti-Vegas sentiment. We aren't upset that Vegas was handed anything or that they've taken advantage of their situation. We simply don't feel like their fans deserve success so soon. When we've suffered for so long, they can win a cup after the Canucks do, says Bob in Nanaimo. Bob, you might not have anti-Vegas sentiment. There were a lot of people in the inbox last week that disagree with your stance on this, and they do have a lot of anti-Vegas sentiment.
Yeah, they do. And I think it more comes down to, you can appreciate what they did. George McPhee, Kelly McCrimmon, like, they fleeced other GMs. I don't want to say they got away with it, but they did it smartly. They got a team, and they built a team based on watching other teams around the NHL, looking at what's good, what works, and they found those players to fit into their system. They had a good coach at the right time. You know, Gerard Gallant just happened to be available. He's a really good one. And I do think that it is more about the fans, and that's fine. I mean, Scott, we've been in Vancouver long enough. You know, no Stanley Cup. Calgary hasn't had a Stanley Cup since 89, and the last cup run was 2004. So there has been a lot of angry fans in this market being, okay, like, we've suffered enough. They should have to have a little bit of that prior to getting to have some of the enjoyment that their fans feel. Because, I mean, if you're talking to a Vegas fan, this is all they know. They're like, wait, you missed the playoffs? That's a thing.
Ian in Victoria says, do you not find it suspect that Tampa's management of the injury, talking Kucherov here, exactly aligns with the start of the playoffs? It's BS, says Ian in Victoria. When he underwent surgery, there's no way they could have accurately predicted how he was going to recover. Could Nikita Kucherov have played before the end of the regular season? Yes. Could Carey Price have played before the end of the regular season? Yes. Could Brendan Gallagher? Yes. We can go down the list of players who could have played before the end of the regular season. This obviously is different because he didn't play any regular season games. Injury manipulation, cap manipulation happens all the time.
I will say this, Scott, I know we got to get to break, but when they chose to do the surgery, this is just me putting my tinfoil hat on here, it's conspiracy Karen, they probably had a kind of timeline what it was going to be and probably knew when he was going to be able to come back and be ready for the playoffs. But I agree with you. Like, I don't think it was calculated in terms of, okay, maybe he doesn't need surgery. He does. Let's give him the surgery. We get cap relief. Like, I don't think it's that. But I do think there may have been some. Does the timing work out well? I think the timing works out well.
Well, you hope it will. You hope it will. Yeah. But how can you accurately predict how somebody's going to come back from surgery? You can't. You have a timeline that you hope for, but you don't know. And here's the other part. This is what's the most incredible part. Like, people focusing on the cap circumvention, if that's what you want to call it, to me, are missing the point. Most guys come back after that long of a layoff, and they can't keep up for more than a game or more than a period. They look completely out of sorts. The fact that his conditioning and stamina are to a point where he can be... The guy's leading the playoffs in scoring. It's incredible.
Well, and I think, too, it probably did help. If we had seen him, if he could have played and got his feet wet in games in the regular season, he would have. And probably you would have seen a slower down Nikita Kucherov. Like, I think that he got the extra conditioning in practice, and there was probably a lot of stuff that we didn't see in terms of what he could do on the ice that media wasn't able to see. I do think that's probably a benefit to him. I'm not saying that, like, you know, they fully did a manipulation of the cap, and you don't know how someone's going to require or going to recover from a surgery. But, you know, if you want to put your tinfoil hat on, you can kind of say, maybe they decided to do it this month versus a month before or a month after. Just saying.
Watch out for the lightning strikes. I'll tell you that. Pardon the pun. It's Rintoul. It's Sermon. Notes and quotes coming your way next.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
No one will harass you if Vegas won the cup, but we would hear it from Montreal fans, Scott. That's one of the texts that comes in today. Does that factor into your thinking as to who to cheer for, who to support? What's your objective point of view? I guess it's not really an objective point of view when I ask you, hey, how does Montreal do in this series? Most people think Montreal will show well, but ultimately concede this series to Vegas when all is said and done. At least our response.
So far, you know, almost 800 votes, and it's win the series versus Vegas 21%, show well 44%, and get rolled by Vegas 35%. I mean, show well is kind of like the, I don't know, answer. It's the, you're kind of sitting on the fence, not taking a hard stance. I just don't see them getting rolled. I think they, at this point, you're in the semifinals, conference final, whatever you want to call it, for a reason. They deserve to be there. They beat two teams that I thought were really good, that were primed to make long playoff runs. And I'm just more, for me, it's the newness of seeing these two teams play. That's what I'm most curious in, just to see. You know, it's Dominic Ducharme has made some adjustments that he made really well in the playoffs, and he's found some consistency. But what happens when you play a new opponent and Vegas starts coming at you with waves, and maybe you get down 2-0? What's going to happen in a game? So it's more for me the curiosity factor versus, and I think in the end, I mean, Montreal has the pieces to make it through. I think that Vegas has more pieces to win. But again, it's just, I'm curious to see. I don't really have any more, you know, in-depth solid analysis of that. It's just, it's going to be nice to see them play a very different team today.
Yeah, I'm with you. The curiosity factor is extremely high, and we can all guess at what the forecheck looks like or the tactics. Let's just enjoy it for what it is. And it's something a lot different than we've seen. A lot different than what we've seen. Like, this is the first time that we've been to the notes and quotes portion of the show, Karen, and we can't reference season series against the opponent. Well, this is what happened. Toronto won this many of the 10 meetings this season, or, you know, Winnipeg did this again. Nope. No idea. No idea. These teams haven't faced each other forever.
January 18th, you have in the notes, Scott, 2020. I mean, that's pre-pandemic, obviously. Seems like a lifetime ago at this point. It's the teams themselves. Vegas has been pretty consistent in what they've been icing over the last couple of years. Montreal, you got some fresh blood. You've got some acquisitions. I'm interested to see how the Eric Staal, Corey Perry line can try and hem the puck in against, if they can have some solid puck possession. I'm curious to see what Nick Suzuki and Cole Caulfield can do, because we know what Vegas's forward line depth looks like, and see if they can break through there. It's going to be, there's going to be some questions, and it's going to be very interesting to see.
Notes and quotes. Let's do it. Let's get to it, Greg.
Oh, yeah. Totally forgot we had a thing, Scott. You take a week off and totally forgot that we had a beautifully produced intro for Notes and Quotes.
Yeah, we do. Montreal at Vegas. It's game one, as you mentioned, first time since January 18th of 2020. Just put this into your consideration. Josh Anderson, Tyler Toffoli, Cole Caulfield, Joel Edmondson, Corey Perry. They weren't Montreal Canadiens the last time these teams played. As you mentioned, Karen, there's been a lot more consistency in Vegas's roster. But Alex Pietrangelo is a pretty big difference from the last time these two teams played. Matthias Janmark, obviously acquired at the trade deadline. He's another guy who was not a Golden Knight. Jeff Petrie made the trip to Vegas. He was skating with the extras today, so
yes,
we don't expect him to play tonight unless that's some sort of subterfuge from Dominique Ducharme and the Montreal Canadiens.
Big loss for them. Logged a lot of heavy minutes, top pairing. They rely heavily on their top two pairings in Montreal. So if he can't play tonight, you probably have to think that he's going to try his best to get back. I'm assuming it has to do something with gripping the stick. I don't know. We know that he cut his fingers in the picture hole or the camera hole of the glass there. So a really weird injury, but big loss for them trying to make up those minutes on that blue line.
You asked, what's it going to be like playing a fresh opponent? Obviously, that's a question on a lot of people's mind. Alex Tuck of the Vegas Golden Knights, he's only seen competition within the West this year. His thoughts on playing a brand new opponent tonight?
It definitely is a bit different. Playing teams 8 times in the regular season and then 6 and 7 times in the postseason, you get really used to a team. Montreal is a completely different team than both Minnesota and Colorado. We had a few days to prepare for them, watch video, and I know a lot of the guys, I think almost everyone had watched them throughout the entire postseason. So we know what to expect, and but we have to first and foremost focus on our game.
I don't mind this aspect of it for this year. I do want them to go back, and I know they're going to mm-hmm. hey, every team gets into every building every single year. But I don't mind this aspect for this year, Karen. It's unique. It's different. The other thing that I would like to see continue, I'm wondering where players come out on this, is when they get to the stage of the Final Four, is there the possibility of re-ranking and going with point totals? Probably not, because they like the Eastern Conference and the Western Conference and the clarity that it gives in the path to the Stanley Cup Final. I am here for that discussion, though. I'm here for the discussion of, you know what? Why not have the possibility of the top two teams being in the same conference and maybe meeting up in the Stanley Cup Final when all is said and done?
I wanted to throw this at you because, okay, Islanders and Tampa do have the history. And we talked about how the rosters are basically the same as last year. We saw them compete to go to the Stanley Cup Final. So maybe there is some animosity left over for that. But, like, what do you expect intensity-wise in terms of will there be any Florida-Tampa Bay or anything like that? First time playing this season, they don't have the history in the playoffs. They play each other twice a season. Like, there's really nothing there other than the Max Pacioretty trade situation that I guess puts a little bit more intrigue and connects these two teams. But it just, to me, it's like, does it get up there because it is the right to go to the Stanley Cup Final? Or is there maybe just a lack of it because of they just don't have any sort of history to draw back on?
They'll turn it up a little, and how much of an impact can Vegas's fourth line have in this series? Do they try to play that heavy style and push Montreal around a little bit, set the tone for the series in that regard? We've talked about the size of the Canadiens, and especially that back end. They're not just guys who are going to go away quietly. They'll push back in this series. Josh Anderson, he's got some size. He brings that to the party. He can play a very physical brand of hockey. We know that theoretically he is built for this time of year. One of the questions we've got, how's Montreal going to respond to having that many mm-hmm. people, that kind of environment? It's really going from 0 to 60 as far as atmospheres go. Here's what Josh Anderson had to say about the excitement level for his team going into Vegas's barn tonight.
Yeah, 100%. Obviously, we got a little bit of a taste at it at home with the Bell Center, and just having 2,500 fans in there, felt similar to a packed house. So coming in here, with the building, fully packed, it's going to be excited, and a lot of people are thinking that it's going to be an advantage for Vegas. But listen, we haven't played in front of a crowd and all season long, so I think we're going to be very excited to feel that energy from the crowd and take full advantage of it.
Do they just stand around during the anthems, just going, "What the heck is happening? I haven't seen this." People,
anthems,
give me a break.
Not just one,
right? Two anthems. Well, this is what the American National Anthem sounds like. Yeah, no, I think it'll be great. I think they'll draw from it. I did say earlier in the show, maybe the one thing, if you see a couple of turnovers early on, it's just the communication issue because they're not used to having any noise there to disrupt that. But I do think for Montreal, it's going to be a lot more energizing. I'd be more curious, Game 3, back in Montreal, and see what happens in terms of Vegas and Montreal going from a packed state backed arena to 2,500, maybe a little bit more fans in there. That's what my there's so much curiosity to this, but I do think that might be where the aspect of lack of fans comes into effect.
If you've been to Vegas, if you've been to a game in that building, you know how raucous it is. If you haven't,
I would
suggest you seek out Chris Versteeg's description of it. He played his final game in the NHL there, and he talked about the fact that it was so loud, there's so much bass pumping through that a guy who had his beer sitting on the railing, the beer just fell off because of the reverberations within the arena. And he said during warm-up, because there's so much bass in that sound system, they crank it so loud there that pucks were vibrating on the ice.
That's awesome. Yeah. Oh, I want to get back to that, Scott. Vegas, baby.
Amen to that. Pete DeBoer, Montreal, what's it going to be like? What do you see? How much have you broken down? DeBoer says we're a little more focused on ourselves.
We've spent a lot of time on watching them, particularly in the playoffs. I think that's when they've kind of found their identity, and their systems under their new coach seem to be more seamless. But that's all you can do. And I'll be honest with you. A lot of this is about our game. We want to translate a lot of the things we did well to beat a really tough Minnesota team and a really tough Colorado team into this series.
Cap tip to Pete DeBoer. They went down 0-2 in that series to Colorado, and he kind of felt like things were turning already. Most of us didn't see it. He did. He sold that belief in his room. The players, to a man, said, "We're going to get this thing back on the rails." They won the next four.
Yeah, good with them. I mean, both of these teams coming in, what, Montreal's won 7 straight games, and Vegas has won 4 in a row, 2 pretty hot teams. And I mean, at this point, you really, it's going to be a feeling out process for them just to see, like, yeah, you have to be more concerned about your game because you want to be able to dictate it to Montreal and try not to have them bring it to you. So I think you will see some feeling out process in this. We saw the Islanders yesterday be able to play a perfect game almost against Tampa Bay and get them out of their game and their rhythm and make mistakes and do things that they're uncharacteristic with. So we'll see if Vegas can do that. But I wouldn't be surprised if there is just a bit of a feeling out process in terms of what these two teams and see what strategies they can change going forward.
Last but certainly not least, the head coach of the visiting Montreal Canadiens. You and I said earlier in the program that Cole Caulfield strikes both of us as the type of player who relishes the spotlight. The higher the stakes, the better he plays. The head coach thinks that his young winger might be on the verge of breaking out.
He's getting some good chances, some good looks, you know, and at times, you know, goal scorers like this, you know, they put one in and they can go on a roll for 5, 6, 7 games. And we can see it with Tyler. You know, he didn't score early in the playoff round against Toronto. And then once he got going, you know, he's been on a hot streak. So I think it can be happening the same thing with Cole.
Sure could. Young man's got a little something. He's got that it factor to him. See if he's buzzing tonight. Game one, Vegas, Montreal. Any of your last thoughts where you see Montreal in this series? You think they're going to show well? You think they're actually going to pull off the win? Or whether you think they're going to get rolled? You can get those texts in before the end of the program. 650, 650, 960, 960. I can't believe we're talking about the Phoenix Suns already into the third round of the NBA playoffs. They took care of the sweep last night. We saw Milwaukee really get back into its series. And now the Nets, big questions about the health of that team. You asked Donovan Bennett about it early in the program. Like, James Harden's been out with a hamstring injury. Okay, we still got 2 stars. Nope, now you've only got 1 after the Kyrie Irving ankle injury. We don't know how bad it is. We don't know how bad Irving's ankle injury is, but boy, it's worrisome if it's bad and he's going to have to miss some time.
X-rays negative, doubtful, though. I believe Shams tweeted that out, Shams Serena with The Athletic earlier today. Doubtful, so is James Harden. So that leaves it all on Kevin Durant's shoulders. He's a great player. He's an absolutely great player. He is one of the top 5 players in the NBA. I don't know if you're going up against an MVP caliber in Giannis Antetokounmpo and his supporting cast. I don't know if KD has the shoulders or the ability or the supporting cast around him without James Harden, without Kyrie Irving, to draw them out of this series. The Bucks have figured something out. 1, they put PJ Tucker when he's on him. He held him to 9 points last night when PJ Tucker was guarding him. 25% shooting. And if they're going to allow him to play physical and beat up Kevin Durant, then I think Milwaukee's definitely coming out of this series. It's just too big of a task with the talent on the other sides, personally, for me, for KD to do this all himself.
We'll see. It's the one thing you can't really say Kevin Durant has done. He's got championships now. He's got an MVP. He scores all over the place. He's going straight into the Hall of Fame. He has not had the challenge of, all right, you're going to have to put a team on your back by yourself. He hasn't had to do that. He had surrounding talent with him in Oklahoma City. He obviously had that in Golden State. He's supposed to have that right now in Brooklyn. He doesn't have it. We'll see tomorrow. That series resumes on Tuesday. Today, we got Game 4, Philly-Atlanta. Hawks were a good story in grabbing the opener on the road in Philly. Got to hold home court now. Got to try to even this series after the 76ers have taken control over the last couple of games.
Yeah, Joel Embiid, Scott, you and I have had injuries and played through things. Could you imagine having a torn meniscus in your knee and having to play the way the minutes that he's playing and how well he's playing? Like, it's just incredible. I think Philly's, again, their depth is just too much for Atlanta. It's a fun story. They're fun to watch. Trae Young is phenomenal, and I think he's making a name and changing the narrative about him in this playoffs, but I think it's Philly's series to lose at this point. Utah and the Clippers, this is the one I'm really interested in. I would like to see a Utah-Phoenix Western Conference final, get the LA teams out of here. However, there is a story about, you know, Chris Paul playing against the Clippers, never got it done there. He's in the Western Conference final for Phoenix. But yeah, the Jazz up 2-1, LA looking to take care of home court advantage.
Is there even going to be any other talking point other than Chris Paul if the Clippers don't advance to the Western Conference final? Like Devin Booker a little bit, but Utah's just
He's
not one of those teams. Utah's just not one of those teams, and they're really good, and Donovan Mitchell is a rising star in this league. But it doesn't have the same sell, does it?
It doesn't. One, it's L.A. It's Steve Ballmer finally getting the Clippers. The Clippers have never been to the Western Conference Final. It's finally getting over that hump. It's Kawhi. Can he lead a third team to the NBA Finals, possibly win another title with a different team? I mean, where does that put him in the hierarchy of NBA greats if he can do that? It's Chris Paul, you know, against his former team. He was never able to get it done, but can he lead this plucky Suns team that, you know, were good in the bubble, but they were basically mediocre for so long. They haven't done anything in 10 years. Like, not only have they're in the Western Conference Final, they haven't been in the playoffs since Steve Nash took them there back in the, oh, there's that storyline. Brooklyn and Phoenix, forgot about that one. But I do think that, yes, if you're looking at the bigger storylines, you need to see LA in there. I just like watching Utah play. They're fun. They shoot a lot of threes. They play really good defense. They've got guys that can come off the bench and are very dynamic. Like, that's the only reason that I would like to see Utah play the Suns in the Western Conference Final.
I got to tip my cap to you, because when we talked about the Lakers-Suns series, I said, look, whether you like him or not, the playoffs are better with LeBron going further and Phoenix. Phoenix has been really exciting since then. They weren't terribly exciting in beating the Lakers out. They're really exciting against the Nuggets. I wish the series hadn't ended the way it did. I think it's brutal that they threw Jokic out for what he did. It's a frustration foul, but it's not something that should have gotten him kicked out of the game. He didn't club Cameron Payne. I know he came down hard on the ball, and I know it's a long way away from his own end and defending. That shouldn't get you thrown out of last night's game.
Not when the stakes are that high. And I hate saying that, because it's like, okay, if someone... should someone be suspended for how injured a player is? Like, I mean, we generally don't look at that. So it's like, this is the possible elimination game. Do you want the MVP kicked out because of the game it is? But if it's a game in the regular season, is that a flagrant too? Like, I saw a lot of NBA players, I think John Morant was one of them, tweeting out saying, so soft, our league is soft, and thinking it's a stupid play. I hate the fact that it was Jokic, and if it was LeBron, he probably wouldn't get kicked out of the game, so there is that. But it just doesn't look good, and the frustration foul at the time of the game. But I think if you're the refs, you'd probably lean toward flagrant one, because then he doesn't get kicked out, but he doesn't get the technical. So I just think it sucks for his season, MVP season, to end that way.
One more note coming in here just before the end of the program. Doesn't have to deal with a game or a match today, but it does for the foreseeable future. Wimbledon going to start at 50% capacity this year. 100% capacity for the final. That's what they believe, that they can ramp it up as far as fans go over the course of that tournament at the All England Club.
That's interesting to me, because I did see that Boris Johnson had slowed down their reopening because of the Delta variant in the UK. So, again, maybe this is a situation where it's vaccinated people being allowed in. I like it. It was really weird watching the French Open. And I do like how for the Nadal-Djokovic match, Scott, you probably talked about it last week, but how the health authorities said it's past the 11 p.m. curfew, but you can stay and watch, because this is just incredible. But it was always weird to see at like 8:30, the fans got the warning call, okay, you got to leave. And then by like 8:45, 15-minute warning, you got to leave. And then there's no fans in the stadium. So I like the fact that there will be at Wimbledon. Just hope it's done in a safe manner and we're all good.
Like flickering the lights at the bar. Hey, you're going to have to be out of here pretty soon.
Right? As soon as the lights turn on, it's like, get out of here.
You remember that, when we could go to bars? It won't be that far.
Nope.
It won't be that much further in advance. Great having you back today, Karen. Awesome stuff.
Thanks,
we
Scott.
Will do this again tomorrow. She's Sermon. I'm Rintoul. Big ups to Greg Ballack back at Mission Control. Producer Jamie Dodd, fine job as always. Our listeners brought it once again today in the text message inbox. Thank you very much for that. We'll do so again tomorrow. We'll turn you over to the big show in Calgary, Bick and the Boss in Vancouver. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. By the way, 0-0 at the break between Spain and Sweden. We will talk to you on Tuesday morning.